The Indians of this country are in a deplorable condition. It's a national disgrace how we've treated the Indians, and there's no question that something must be done.
The voice you just heard hardly needs an introduction. Senator Robert F. Kennedy is our guest this week on NER Washington Forum, a weekly program concerned with significant issues in the news. I'm National Educational Radio Public Affairs Director Vic Sussman. Senator Kennedy has long been noted for his deep interest in the affairs of the poor. Not long ago, he traveled to a region in Kentucky to see firsthand the tortured existence led by the poor of that state, a not untypical existence for perhaps one-fifth of the population of this, the richest nation in the world. Senator Kennedy is also interested in another section of the American poor, an all but forgotten segment of the national scene, the American Indian. The senator is a member of the Senate Subcommittee on Indian Affairs, which recently began hearings. Kennedy is also the head of another Senate subcommittee, which has been for some time investigating the question of Indian education. This subcommittee has traveled to Indian reservations and has compiled a vast file of material on the conditions under which the Indian must live or attempt to live. Just after we interviewed Senator Kennedy, the President sent a message to Congress entitled "The Forgotten American." The opening pages reflect the tragedy of the once proud Indian. Mississippi and Utah, the Potomac and the Chattahoochee, Appalachia and Shenandoah. The words of the Indian have become our words, the names of our states and streams and landmarks. His myths and his heroes enrich our literature. His lore colors our art and our language. For two centuries, the American Indian has been a symbol of the drama and excitement of the earliest America. But for two centuries, he has been an alien in his own land. Relations between the United States government and the tribes were originally in the hands of the War Department. Until 1871, the United States treated the Indian tribes as foreign nations. It has only been 44 years since the United States affirmed the Indian citizenship, the full potential equality essential for human dignity in a democratic society. It has only been 22 years since Congress enacted the Indian Claims Act to acknowledge the nation's debt to the first Americans for their land. But political equality and compensation for ancestral lands are not enough. The American Indian deserves a chance to develop his talents and share fully in the future of our nation. There are about 600,000 Indians in America today. Some 400,000 live on or near reservations in 25 states. The remaining 200,000 have moved to our cities and towns. The most striking fact about the American Indians today is their tragic plight. 50,000 Indian families live in unsanitary, dilapidated dwellings, many in huts, shanties, even abandoned automobiles. The unemployed rate among Indians is nearly 40%, more than 10 times the national average. 50% of Indian school children, double the national average, drop out before completing high school. Indian literacy rates are among the lowest in the nation. The rates of sickness and poverty are among the highest. Thousands of Indians who have migrated into the cities find themselves untrained for jobs and unprepared for urban life. The average age of death of an American Indian today is 44 years. For all other Americans, it is 65. The American Indian, once proud and free, is torn now between white and tribal values, between the politics and language of the white man and his own historic culture. His problems, sharpened by years of defeat and exploitation, neglect and inadequate effort, will take many years to overcome. To find out more about what can be done for the American Indian, what is being done, NER Washington Forum traveled to the Senate offices of Robert Kennedy and discussed with him the facts and material the senator has collected. First, I asked the senator what had prompted his interest in the life of the American Indian.
Just think that the fact that they've suffered more than any other group or any other minority and continue to suffer more, and perhaps less interest and less effort made for the Indians than in any other group. There's less attention focused on them and the problems that they face than any other minority group. but by all criteria, they suffer more. They suffer more in the field of education. They suffer more in their opportunities to obtain employment. They suffer more as far as health is concerned than any other group, far more than the Negroes, far more than Puerto Ricans or the Mexican Americans.
How many Indians are there in the United States?
Approximately 600,000.
And are most of these on reservations, or are they integrated into the society?
Oh, there's some of each. They're on reservations. In some areas, they're integrated into society. Well, and there's more of an effort now to try to integrate them into society, but without the preparation. There's an effort to take them off the reservations, but there's no effort to try to prepare them for the kind of life they will lead when they move to a city or if they move off the reservation. Their children aren't educated properly. They're not trained properly. There is an entirely different kind of a philosophy on the reservation and an Indian family life than there is amongst white men, and they're not prepared for that. Of course, their culture is different and their language is different, so it makes it very difficult for them to be integrated into the community unless some special steps are taken, some special effort is made, and none of that's been done so far.
Well, who is charged, what agency of the government is this?
Department of Bureau of Indian Affairs, which is under the Department of Interior.
What sort of job are they doing? What sort of job have they done?
Well, we'll have more to say about that when we finish our hearings. I think I have some very grave reservations about the effectiveness of the program. I don't think it's all the fault of the Bureau of Indian Affairs, but I do think in many areas that that's become a bureaucracy and filled with red tape. But secondly, I think we've established a system of paternalism, which is in some areas destroyed the Indian, has destroyed his dignity, and destroyed the possibility of his accomplishing the kinds of things that we all want to achieve. I think we might say that the Bureau of Indian Affairs has frequently castrated the Indian, so that the Indian has been put under a welfare system and hasn't been able to think for himself, act for himself, work for himself, or live the kind of life that he would like to live and should be permitted to live. And as that system has been developed and established, it's fed on itself. If the Indian goes off by himself, or if we prepare the Indian to leave the reservation, lead the life of his own, there'll be less reason for our existence. That is the argument of some of those in the Bureau of Indian Affairs, whether they state it publicly or whether it's just thought privately. And that's what is of such concern to me.
Why are there reservations at all? Isn't this a form of segregation or concentration?
Well, the idea was that as we came in, as white men came in and started taking Indians' property, Indians' land, our conscience started to bother us after about 100 years, and after we had gotten most of the good land, we said, well, we won't take any more of the land. We'll let them live in certain areas of the country. That was the theory behind it. So we established these reservations in which Indians could live and that the white man couldn't touch. And that was the philosophy behind it. And it's right that the Indians should have some territory that's been saved for them. But they should also be permitted to leave, and should be encouraged to leave, but encouraged to leave under the right circumstances, and not made to leave. And also, the road should be smoothed out for them when they do leave. And that means proper education, proper training, and the possibility and opportunities to attain jobs. And none of that's been done. We have 65% dropout rate, for instance, from children from school amongst Indians. Many of the Indian children in the ninth grade are 3 and 4 and 5 years behind their contemporaries. And many of the Indian children are filled with such hopelessness and such despair that in some areas of the United States, the greatest cause of death amongst Indian teenagers is suicide. Well, we know that that's an unsatisfactory situation.
In 1965, I was in Browning, Montana, which is the home of the Blackfoot Nation, and I had an opportunity to see pretty much at first hand just what the town of Browning looks like. And it's sort of what you described in the midst of all that grandeur as a Western slum. Now, is this typical of Indian reservations? Are they all as drab and
some
hopeless?
Of them are. I think that they vary. Some of them are. Some of them are a little bit better. But I should say, generally, the conditions that the Indians live under in the United States is a national disgrace. We visited eastern Oklahoma, and we found a large number of Cherokee families with an average income of less than $1,000. Now, the Cherokees were one of the proudest and most capable of Indian tribes. They had one of the best educational systems that has ever been established in the world 70 years ago. We destroyed their educational system, made them accept an educational system run by the Bureau of Indian Affairs and by the localities, and thus they are terribly, very, very badly educated at the moment. And therefore they can't find jobs, and 90% of them in Adair County, the 90% of the Cherokee families are on welfare. There are no jobs been provided for them by the Bureau of Indian Affairs. There's no jobs been provided for them by industry or by the federal government. They don't have the training or the education to hold any kind of meaningful employment in any case, and so they all go on welfare, and they come under the control of the state, and are thus destroyed. And it seems to me that our whole philosophy and our whole approach to this subject has been very unsatisfactory.
Well, I understand that
the housing is deplorable in many of the areas that we went to and visited, and the whole concept of taking a child. I mean, here we are in the United States, and we deplore communism, we deplore the system that's followed by the communist state of breaking up the family and destroying the family unit. Here we are in the United States because we decide not to build educational facilities near where the Indians live. We go in and take children forcefully at the age of 5 and 6 years of age, 7 years of age. We take those children forcefully from their parents, away from their home, send them off to school 1,000 miles away, and make them go to boarding school, don't even provide them enough money so that they can return to their families at Christmas or any other time of vacation. And we say that's an educational system. Now, that we would criticize that if it was followed in communist China or the Soviet Union, and yet that's exactly what we do here in the United States.
Now, I understand that although the Indians live on the reservations, they don't actually own the land. It's said that the land belongs to them, but they can't lease it, they can't sell it, they can't dispose of it in any way.
That's correct.
Well, what can be done about this sort of thing? You talk about their ancestral home, and yet they're living on government land, is it?
That's correct.
Can anything be done about
this? Well, at various times, legislation has been offered to try to change that so that Indians can dispose of property. But even that hasn't been successful. So the point is that it's not just the Bureau of Indian Affairs that's made mistakes. I think that our whole government, whole society has, down through the years. And what we're trying to do with this committee is perhaps focus more attention on what the problems are and what needs to be done. The Indians are not active participants in the democratic system. And by that I mean they don't vote in large numbers, so that therefore they have less of a clout. People or political figures perhaps are less interested in them and what happens to them, because they can't come in and say in large numbers, if you don't do something, if you don't change this at the federal level, then we're not going to vote for you anymore. So it's for that reason also they have a more difficult time.
Well, I've heard there's some sort of Indian Resources Bill before Congress, or that there was before Congress. Has this been lost in committee? Do you know anything about it? It certainly isn't something that's known much about publicly.
Well, it's pending now, but again, its fate is certainly uncertain.
Now, the Indians in the United States, as you've pointed out, seem to be under some sort of trusteeship, which goes back to grade B cowboy movies and the Great White Father Syndrome. Is this sort of paternalism, you've hinted at this earlier now, is this sort of paternalism the sort of attitude we want to have toward the Indians?
No, I don't think so. I think that they should be we should change so that we're not running their affairs, but that we are working with them, that we give them positions of responsibility and a sense that they control their own, and a feeling that they can control their own future. That we have not done at all, that they have some control over their education, that they have some control over the industry that's going to be in the surrounding area or on the reservation, that they have control over the justice that is meted out to their people, that they have some control, for instance, over the drafting of their young men. The Indians serve in the armed forces at a very, very high rate, much, much higher, more than twice the rate of white people. They're called to serve, and they serve in large numbers in Vietnam, for instance, and have suffered heavy casualties in Vietnam, but yet very few Indians are placed on draft boards. Others are the ones that the white people in the locality decide who's going to go, and they frequently call Indians and send them off to the war and give deferments to young white men.
Now, I've heard that people, especially young people these days, say that the U.S. government at one time had a real policy of genocide toward the Indians, that the goal of the U.S. cavalry was to wipe them out. Do you feel this is true? Has the U.S. been this guilty of crimes toward the Indians?
Well, I think without any question we were very cruel, and without any question we destroyed the Indian, and we destroyed his culture, as well as killing Indians in large numbers. I don't think the history books that have been written about the struggle between the Indian and the white man has been at all true or accurate about the cruelty of the white population against the Indians.
There seems to be an increased interest in Indians these days, not just with your subcommittee, but especially among hippies. They seem to go for the Indian tribal existence and this sort of thing. Do you think this renewed interest in Indians on any level is going to be helpful?
Yes, without any question it will be. I think it's more people that take up their cause.
Well, what should the goal be? Should the goal be to take an Indian and have him assimilated into society, or to have him preserve his unique heritage and his language, or should this be wiped
out? I think it's really up to what the Indian wants to do.
In other words, to give him the choice.
Yes, give him the choice. I think it's terribly important that we have these various cultures in the United States, whether it's the backgrounds of the Germans, the Poles, the Italians, Jewish, Irish, whatever they might be, Negro. I think that that's brought great strength to this country and to our society. I'd hate to have that disappear. I'd certainly hate to have it disappear as far as the Indians are concerned. But what they want to do, how they want to live, and under what circumstances they want to live, and how they're going to keep their culture and their history and their beliefs alive, really should be left up to them. If they wish to, then it should be encouraged. If they want to become more assimilated, those who want to become more assimilated should be permitted to become assimilated. But all of that should be developed in a program of the Indians working with the government, and not the federal government deciding what's best for the Indians, as we have on all occasions up to the present time. And what we've developed has obviously not been best for the Indian. The Indian has the poorest self-image of any group in the United States. Here we've spent hundreds and hundreds of millions of dollars on the Indians and helping the Indians, and yet they, after this is all over, the educational system is unsatisfactory, the job opportunities are inadequate, the housing is deplorable, the living conditions are completely unacceptable, and on top of all that, the Indian has the worst self-image of any group. And that's all because we run it. We have run it. We've operated it, so that we have to take the responsibility.
Now, I've heard the Bureau of Indian Affairs asks for or tries to get about $300 million to administer to the needs of something like 600,000 Indians. Is this money well spent? What's it spent on, most of it? Education or rehabilitation?
Well, a lot of it's spent on education. A lot of it's spent on salaries of people who work for the Bureau of Indian Affairs. I think that I don't think all we have to do is look at the record and understand that large sums of money have been wasted and haven't been utilized properly.
If you could alter the lives of as you're trying to do, these 600,000 or so Indians in the U.S., if you could change their lives tomorrow, what would you do? What sort of program could you outline for us?
Well, I think that's difficult, particularly as we've been in operation for such a short period of time.
What would you like to see?
Well, first, I think that it's terribly important to have an adequate educational system for the children. And that means if we're going to have Bureau of Indian Affairs schools, then we should have the best possible schools, we should have good teachers, we should have teachers that have some relationship with the children, and frequently they do not. They should have teachers that have some association with the parents of the Indian children, and frequently they do not. Or only, I might put it a different way, only very, very occasionally do they. I think that we should have a regular educational system, we should have preschool educational system, to prepare the child. We should have where the children come out of a home where English is not talked, is not where the conversation is not in English, that there should be some special remedial programs to prepare the child. I think there should be a possibility for a child, Indian children, to go on to higher education. There's very little of that at the present time. I think if the child goes into the public school system, some special effort should be made to prepare the child before he enters that educational system, and secondly, while he's in the educational system, to assist him in the special problems that he will face. We have a terribly, terribly high dropout rate by the time the child gets to the age of 14, 15, and 16. The philosophy of the Indian is entirely different. The philosophy of the Indian is to share with his family, to share with his neighbors, to is not so much, is not focused on himself. In the educational system, there is tremendous attention on what the individual does, how he does in his class, how he does in particular courses. Well, that change in philosophy is very, very difficult to adjust to. We have done nothing to prepare the Indian child. So I think there's a lot that needs to be done in education. I think that we should provide jobs for the young Indian men and women. Now, that might require a federal job program, but we did it in the 1930s. The unemployment rate in many of these areas is 80% amongst the Indians. Let's go in there and provide jobs, not just welfare checks. That's not an adequate or satisfactory life. That's not going to permit the Indian man to bring up his family in dignity, and where his children are going to be proud of him, that he never goes to work, he just receives a welfare check every two, four weeks. It's an unsatisfactory situation. And has his hand out for food. So let's provide jobs for them. And there's a lot that needs to be done. There's training programs that we could establish with jobs at the end of it, not just training programs that are dead end, but training programs with jobs at the end of it. They could work on housing, they could work on the construction of schools, they could work on recreational facilities, they could work on sanitary facilities. All of these things need to be done, desperately need to be done, in Indian reservations and in areas where large numbers of Indians live and work. Special programs established for Indians to go into cities. So many of the Indians leave the reservation and decide they're going to make a new life. They go into a city or community, they have no place to turn, no one to help them, no one to give them guidance, no one to give them help, no one to give them assistance. Well, there should be done that. When immigrant groups came from other countries in the past to the United States, there were people in the community that helped them to adjust. There's nothing like that done for the Indians. So these are some of the areas. There's a great deal that needs to be done about health. Indians' children die at a much higher rate than white children. Their disease of the eyes and of the ears is much, much greater than children who are not Indians. Why should that be true? Why shouldn't we provide adequate medical care and assistance for Indians and Indian children? So these are some of the areas which I would attack.
Realistically, though, since we're involved in a war in Vietnam that's costing billions of dollars, the Kerner Commission recently asked for billions and millions of dollars to aid the cities. Where is the money going to come from?
Well, we have a gross national product of $800 billion. That means we can afford a great deal here in this country. We're going to buy 9 million new cars here in the United States this year, as compared to 6 million, less than 6 million 6 years ago. So we're much more wealthy, much more affluent. We're going to spend $3 billion on pets. So I think that we have the money. And secondly, I changed the philosophy of the programs. I think a lot of the money that we're using now is more damaging. It would have been better if it had never been spent. Not only is it wasted, but it's very, very damaging to the Indian and the Indian's culture and the Indian's opportunity to live a meaningful life.
Senator Robert F. Kennedy, interviewed in his Senate office, speaking on the American Indian. In the time we had with the senator, brief due to his pressing schedule, we could only touch on the all but unknown plight of the red man. It is clear now, with the issuance of the President's message on Indians, that the tragic situation is at least known in high levels of government, and that the conflict and costs of Vietnam notwithstanding, the executive branch hopes to somehow help the Indian. But can that help come in time to save a people, a history, a culture, and preserve a future. Little is said of the Indian. Thus, to read the facts of his life in the president's message is to be shocked. The health level of the American Indian is the lowest of any major population group in the United States. The infant mortality rate among Indians is 34.5 per 1,000 births, 12 points above the national average. The incidence of tuberculosis among Indians and Alaska natives is about 5 times the national average. More than half of the Indians obtain water from contaminated or potentially dangerous sources and use waste disposal facilities that are grossly inadequate. Viral infections, pneumonia, malnutrition, all of which contribute to chronic ill health and mental retardation, are common among Indian children. It will be illuminating for concerned Americans to keep a watchful eye, indeed a voter's eye, a taxpayer's eye, on the eventual outcome of the president's call to Congress to save the Indian. In his message, the president asks for an appropriation of $500 million, about 10% more money than was requested for fiscal 1968. The president also issued an executive order establishing a National Council on Indian Opportunity. The chairman of this council will be Vice President Humphrey, with other members including the Secretaries of Interior, Agriculture, Commerce, Labor, Health, Education and Welfare, Housing, and the Director of the Office of Economic Opportunity. The council will be expected to review federal programs for the Indians and make broad policy recommendations. The president has also directed the government to make changes affecting the Indian. In education, for instance, by making the Head Start program available to 10,000 Indian children and to establish for the first time kindergartens for 4,500 Indian children next September. Mr. Johnson is also asking that a model school system be set up and that Congress appropriate $5.5 million to attract and hold talented teachers at Indian schools. There are other requests touching on all phases of the Indian's life: health, employment, housing, water and sewer projects, civil rights, and even a definition of rights for Eskimos, Aleuts, and Indians of Alaska. We have seen messages like this before, presented to Congress amid a splash of publicity, only to be forgotten, lost in the labyrinths of Capitol Hill. But the Indians have been lost and forgotten for too long. If it happens this time, there may no longer be a crisis to contend with. The Indian problem may no longer confront us. Without help now, without help soon, massive help, the Indian may go the way of his partner of the plains, another victim of the white man's civilization, the buffalo. And our children may one day ask, as they ask of the buffalo, how did it happen? Why did it happen? Why wasn't something done? Our thanks to Senator Robert F. Kennedy for his appearance today on NER Washington Forum. This is National Educational Radio Public Affairs Director Vic Sussman inviting you to join us again next week for another edition of NER Washington Forum, a weekly program concerned with significant issues in the news. This program was produced by WAMU-FM, American University Radio in Washington, D.C. Technical direction by David Eccleston. This is the National Educational Radio Network.